welcome to this week's edition of Books and Booze. We are here with both Joe Clifford and Tom Pitts, or Tom Pitts and Joe Clifford, so nobody gets upset who was named first. It's both. We're once again being brought to you by Long Distance Drunks, the Charles Bukowski tribute anthology, which Joe and Tom are both in, so we'll talk a little bit about that, among other things. This is Renee, and I am drinking the Stone Farking Wheat and Woot Stout that I talk about on the show all the time. It's an amazing beer, and that probably means that I'm going to be kind of sloppy by the end of the show, so 12%. I'm a lightweight.
Oh, boy.
I don't know how to do this in order. Like, usually we have one guest. So, yeah.
Let's go alphabetically.
Okay.
Well, you know, remember the billing you forgot, which is near and dear to both of us, is we are the Flash Fiction Offensive. That is,
right.
Yeah.
Well, we've got a lot of things
flies
to talk
both
about.
Without us having to come to fisticuffs.
If you get a rejection letter from us, you can, you know, we always sign it, Joe and Tom, you know, so that nobody knows who got the rejection. But for the astute rejectee, you will notice that whoever signs their name first, if it's Joe and Tom, Joe rejected you. If it's Tom and Joe, Tom rejected you.
Oh, so
or
it's like
it, as the case may be.
So
yeah.
It's like when you listen to a Beatles song, whoever's singing lead vocal is the one that wrote the lyrics.
Right.
Even though it always says Lennon and
McCartney.
Yeah. Yeah. But exactly like the Beatles, we cash those Flash Fiction offensive checks together.
Yeah.
Stick it into our
just like the Beatles. Yeah.
Mm. So in alphabetical orders, we've decided, Joe, how are you doing and what are you drinking this evening?
I'm drinking coffee out of my Grumpy Cat mug that our mutual agent, Tom and I have the same agent in addition to everything else we share, sent me for Christmas. So that's what I'm doing.
That's really appropriate.
Thank you.
Tom, what are you drinking?
Our agent didn't feel the need to send me any Christmas gifts, so I'll be drinking out of an aluminum can. And I had to forego my traditional IPA, which I would have liked to stop and get, but I had to rush home from the dentist to make this appointment. So I'm actually drinking leftover from Super Bowl canned Coors, just plain old Coors.
Oof.
And you can hear in the background the fabulous opening of the can. Oh, that sounds good.
It doesn't, but... Sure.
Well, I don't have a choice. Maybe I'll throw a shot of Jim Beam in there just to sweeten the deal. But, yeah, it's probably why the same five have been sitting in my fridge the past several weeks. But on a hot day, there's nothing like Coors to cool you down. But it's not hot. It's raining here, so it's pretty miserable and bitter tasting.
Jessica, what are you drinking?
I'll take your Coors and I'll raise you. I've got a PBR.
I was really hoping you were going to say that.
Yeah.
Is that a raise? Is that really a raise, or is that like lateral, or is that even a step down?
It is perhaps a lateral move.
I think
lateral,
it's lateral, okay. But if I have to...
No, that's an improvement, because PBR has the hipster value. Of course, it's just a cheap, shitty beer. I mean, there's a difference.
Yeah.
PBR is
saying,
hey, look at the club.
They're equally as watery.
Yeah,
they're both shitty
beers. What you don't realize, Joe, is that Coors is the new hipster beer because PBR is passé. In the true hipster joint, where hipsters are already drinking the $2 PBR, Coors is where it's at.
What you didn't realize is if you go back about 30 seconds in this clip, you will hear Tom Pitts employ his chicken stop voice. If you've never heard Tom's chicken stop story, that we go back, we'll listen to this, you'll hear it. He affected it. It's a story about it's a gay guy up in the Castro who decides to walk chickens, and Tom delivers the whole story in this particular voice, but he slipped into it momentarily, and when we go into the playback, you're going to hear that voice.
What?
I said chicken,
I heard
stop.
It. I thought he was mocking
No. I'm mocking all of
them. We're
going to
play the tape.
I'm impressed that we've been recording for like less than 5 minutes and there's already a portion that is completely incomprehensible because everyone's talking at once.
Well, had you given a script?
This would be going alphabetical order, but
Mark.
Yeah, Tom talks over me. Always relegating me to the background.
Get used to it. All right, so fire away. What do you got to know? Okay. I'm ready to lie.
So I guess we need to start. This is the question that I felt like we should have asked both of you separately, but will be so much more meaningful now that you're together.
Edgy.
Okay?
Yep.
Yeah.
Who likes to be the big spoon and who likes to be the little spoon? No. All right, go on.
We know, like, we know, and anybody who listens to the episodes you guys were on before know that you guys knew each other kind of at the worst times, lost touch, kind of found each other again. I know that there's like an outline, sort of like, oh yeah, you know, the internet, we found each other, whatever. I want to know, like, what was that first, like, face to face like?
Clifford, let's just call it what it is. Clifford hunted me down.
I felt this emptiness in my life. Even though I'd gotten sober and everything was going great, there was like a hole in my heart that just couldn't be filled until I found him. So I began a vast internet search, which involved, including but not limited to, signing up for all those damn classmate sites to like try to find Tom Pitts. I eventually found him through I don't want to say porn star because that sounds wrong, but a woman who does certain things that maybe other people don't do. And he was like, I know Carmella, who played bass in Tom's band, Short Dogs Grow. And after many years of searching, I was eventually put in touch with him. And then Tom's response was, hey, man, great to hear from you. And the greatest PS ever, you made it out too. And that was nice.
Yeah.
So that was the first. That was the first communication, but that wasn't the first face to face. Like, did you guys run towards each other in slow motion while like music played? Like, was there a meadow?
Oh yeah, we arranged to meet in Cleveland because it was halfway, and we rented a nice hotel room. No, we met like in San Francisco. I think I flew out because I come out all the time, and I would come back like once a year. And I think it was after my second divorce. It's hard when you have that many wives, but it was one of them, and I came out here, and I was seeing another girl, I think. Was it when I saw the stripper girl? Was that when I saw her?
No, you were seeing the nurse, and you came to visit me and Cheryl on our place on San Jose, and I think we were just moving. Like,
Yes,
we went out for a burrito at that place that you love that I think is secondary to the place that I love on 24th Street.
Okay, well, that's what happened with with the
candidate. It wasn't that dramatic. I mean, Joe gave me a couple of issues of it. Was it Gulfstream magazine?
Gulfstream magazine.
He had just gotten in. He's like, look, man, I'm doing this writing thing, and it's awesome. And you know, I was just,
sorry about that.
You know, smoking a lot of reefer and stuff then. And I, you know, words, writing, geez, I don't know. It's good to see you. Glad to see you alive. But, you know, aren't you hungry? And, and it wasn't until a few years later that the whole the whole writing thing seemed to come into focus, for me at least, for, you know, on what the hell he was doing during all this time.
Yeah.
Me, I was languishing.
Sorry, it's not sexier. I wish we should have thought of that beforehand.
No, it's really great because in there were definite moments that sounded like a total like old married couple. Well, you wanted to go to that one burrito place, but it's not as good as the burrito place that I like.
Well, I think
that one went out
loud
when we said that.
It's not
for the big Cancun is better than El Faro. I mean, where do you like El Farolito? Cancun
first of all,
is a significant.
Hey, can we clear the air just so I don't get distorted out of this? It's not El Faro, it's
sure.
El Farolito. And I think in the San Francisco area, will promptly agree. Too bad it's not a live show because there'd be call-ins and your phones would be lit up like a Christmas tree saying, yes, not only does the Bay Guardian and the SF Weekly agree that El Farolito is the best talkery in town, but so does anybody with a rational head or tongue in their mouth. So
you add up from 2000 the number of votes that Cancun has over El Farolito. It's not even close. I don't know who won last year, but significantly, there's a significant advantage to Cancun. Every year they win. Every year.
Remember when?
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what paper you read. What?
What paper do you read?
Who reads the paper? Yeah, what paper do you
read? It's the weekly
paper,
but the SF Weekly and Guardian vote Cancun the best all the time. So I don't know what he's talking about. He's making stuff up.
That's
what Canadians do. They make things up.
Wait,
and then they apologize.
Newspapers voted it the best? Because I don't know that I trust that.
The people.
Everybody knows Cancun is better.
Cool choice.
people in San Francisco read the newspaper because they have to be, like, they have to hold on to
the
huge thing.
We're better class of people, yes, yes.
I had a bad experience once in Cancun.
You don't even live in San Francisco, Joe.
Listen, Bay Area is all the same. It's all the same.
Oh,
no.
I just look at the city twinkling across the bay from my ivory tower or higher in the hill, and I don't have to go over there because it's just too much. Pandemonium. It's too hectic.
Too
much.
I have a bad memory associated with Cancun from when they used to sell half grams of cocaine out of the doorway of the place, and the owner used to let the guys come in. And I got them from there, and I walked about half a block, and I got jacked up by a fake cop who took me on like a 40-minute walk where I thought he had me at gunpoint, but I finally realized he was a fake cop, and he stole my wallet, my ID, and I ended up just a bad experience. So that's why maybe I'm a little bitter towards the old 19th and Mission.
I thought you were talking about the incident with Gavin in the bathroom, because that happened in Cancun, too. I don't know if you remember that.
No, but the one
wow.
I had for Gavin in the bathroom was at the bagel place on 24th Street, but that's a little back.
The problem with opiates tend to back somebody up a little bit, to put it politely. So you don't complete the natural process of digesting food during the normal amount of time. So we were in Cancun, Tom, I, and this guy Gavin, who recently died, so don't laugh too hard, but he was all screwed up. He had like a gimpy arm, and his neck was really long. He had metal rods fused into his back, but it was just us, and we were in there really late at night, and Gavin had to use the restroom. You just hear from the back this blood-curdling because he was, completing the process, which wasn't very comfortable for either Tom and I.
William Burroughs used to say you need the surgical equivalent of an apple core just to deal with that kind of problem, which poor Gavin didn't have, and he yelped. And whenever this would happen, because it happened a few times, the store owner would be, "That's it. I'm calling the police." and he would be in there howling like a wounded coyote.
Just blood curdling. Yeah. Like I saw my wife give childbirth. She didn't scream like he did. Yeah.
And why we didn't leave him here? He had the money on the drugs. We can't go. We got to wait it out.
Yes. Gavin, I don't know. He's Pinkle from Junkie Love, if you read it.
Joe knows I read it.
Yeah.
I haven't read it. I've been lying this whole time.
It's all right. I don't really – as long as you say nice things about it, I don't really care if anybody reads it.
Oh, more of these fake reviews. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Had a review.
So let's talk about Out of the Gutter Online for a minute. You guys run Flash Fiction Offensive. You're both acquisitions editors for Gutter Books, correct?
Technically,
that is correct.
Yeah.
Although,
okay.
The Gutter Books, we were open for submissions last year. We've kind of tapered off taking submissions while we work on getting the books we accepted out, which it took a little longer than any of us thought for the few projects that we took on. And I don't know whether we're opening them back up again, the submissions for the book portion, or if we are, if we're just going to do select stuff, because it was a handful and a lot to do. A lot more than
I don't want to do that again. Yeah, it was rough. Reading submissions was tough. I don't mind doing the actual editing, but going through a slush file is brutal.
Yeah, we need to work out a better process for how to choose and how we're going to work it. But the selected projects we did do are all good, and they're all coming out in their own due time. Mike McCary's book is already out. Mike Monson's book is going to be out soon.
George Fong's book is out. We have Will Vajero's book out. I finished Mike Miner's book. Matt Rozoff is next. And, of course, we have the Springsteen Anthology, which is going to come out sometime soon.
Dunham's was the first one, the first book. But, yeah. I thought the Springsteen Anthology was a Getter/Zelmer release.
Yeah, that just happened. That kind of just blew
so,
up.
Actually, I think I watched the Springsteen Anthology thing, like, kind of happen while I just stood back and was like, I'm cool with being the only girl not invited to the prom because I'm a little bit too, like, no offense to you guys, but I'm a little bit too young to really be in, like, that hardcore with the Springsteen. Okay.
Springsteen. Joe knows my dirty little secret.
Yeah, Tom hates Springsteen. I love Springsteen. I mean, Springsteen.
I don't think there's anything wrong with Bruce Springsteen. It's because he doesn't have like a place in my heart, you know?
Well, maybe your heart's
a little
empty.
Kidney.
He is He is by far the most influential writer on my craft. Springsteen.
Songwriter.
What I was going to ask is, do you want to tell our listeners who maybe weren't Facebook stalking you at the time that this started, kind of what the story behind this was?
The story behind it was Chris Leak had published a story called Candy's Room, which Candy's Room is a track off Darkness on the Edge of Town on Shotgun Honey. And we were just talking, you know, at the office one day on Facebook, somebody's Facebook wall. And one of us, I think it was me or maybe he said it, we should do a collection of crime stories based on Bruce Springsteen. And really, within like 2 weeks, we had writers writing us, and we had this whole thing laid out. We were going to do, 20 stories, 2,000 words, you know, ended up being twice that length. We went to the bosses, took a while to find his lawyers and his PR firm and all that to get permission to use his name. And through that process, I also had, you know, the one ace I had was I went to grad school with Dennis Lehane. I didn't go with him, but I had the same thesis advisor, and he was, you know, a graduate of FIU. So I reached out, and I knew he was a Springsteen fan, and asked if he would contribute, and he agreed. A portion of the net proceeds are going to the Bob Woodward Foundation, which assists veterans, which is nice. But then we had to bring on a bigger publisher because Zellmer, who originally agreed to do it, is just, you know, it's Ryan Sales and those guys. They didn't have quite the capacity to, the distribution that's going to be needed for something like this. So I asked Matt if Gutter, if he wanted to do it. And so he said he'd put it out, and that's where we are. We just got James Grady, who wrote 6 Days of the Condors in it, David James Keaton, who I know you've had on your show, Chris F. Holm, James R. Tuck, Hillary Davidson, Tom Robinson, Keith Rawson, basically a who's who of, the modern noir crime writing thing that's going on.
I really feel like there's like three people that I know that aren't in the anthology, not including myself, like a total of three people that I know.
This is the second time you mentioned not being in the anthology. I mean, you couldn't reach out. I would have moved on to get you in there. I'll kick him out right now. I'll kick Tom out right now.
I've not heard about it.
She doesn't want to do it.
I don't like Springsteen anthology. There's no way that I can say this that isn't going to probably sound like an asshole thing to say, but at this moment, after the amount of beer I've had, I can't even think of a Bruce Springsteen song. I realized that the song I was thinking of was actually John Mellencamp. So.
Oh.
Wow.
Wow.
The Coug.
Oh, man. You know,
really,
what song were you thinking of?
Little Pink Houses.
Oh, okay.
Jesus.
Okay. Yeah.
I
want to do a Taylor Swift anthology, crime stories based on the songs of Taylor Swift. I'm totally serious.
Okay.
I knew you were trouble. I knew you were trouble. 22, mean, it would be awesome.
She
was
I would happily
submit to a Taylor Swift anthology because basically if it's a crime anthology based on Taylor Swift songs, that's some like crazy lady breakup revenge shit.
Look
going
at her titles. They're perfect for crime stories. They're great.
Yeah.
Okay, let's
listen to the one she wrote about John Mayer. What?
Sorry.
The biggest crime was putting that record out in the first place.
Ooh.
Oh, God damn, it's raining like crazy out. I got to batten down the hatches here. Hang on, okay? All right, so, yes, Springsteen, you hate him. Joe loves him. Taylor Swift, never
gonna. I hated him. I just am not that familiar with his body of work. I know he's from New Jersey.
You know
I talked to Matt the other day at Gutter Books. He actually, based on the Springsteen thing, he's going to start a series of rock and roll noir. We're going to do more of these anthologies. Whether we do Taylor Swift next, but we are going to do a rock and roll anthology series.
You got to pitch him.
Gutter Books is me, Tom, and Matt. So we don't move at a fast pace. Yeah.
You got to pitch Queen. Because I was thinking about this today. I was inspired, right? Because you did the Bruce Springsteen thing. And I was listening to a lot of Queen today. Because some days you have those kind of days where you got to listen to a lot of Freddie Mercury. And I was like, oh, my God. Somebody should do a Queen anthology. But I hate editing, so it's not going to be me.
I love editing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm giving that. That's my gift to you. Do it.
Thank you. You're too kind. You're too kind. I don't care what Tom says about you. You're all right. No, that's good. We'll do Queen and Taylor Swift. We will not do Rush because I fucking hate Rush. But there's a bunch of great artists.
Technically very good.
The
Kansas?
Ramones, hello.
The Ramones. I agree with you on the Ramones, yeah. I really
want to pick a weird, you know. Springsteen's perfect just because he's, you know, he's all about that broken American dream, and that's what noir is about. But I think we could have fun with it. Anyway, next question. What are we doing?
Yeah. We got like in a weird place there for a second. But I was going to ask specifically about Flash Fiction Offensive. When, aside from it being short and sweet, what are the kind of things that you're looking for that you haven't seen yet? What do you like? Really want to get your hands on to put out at Flash Fiction Offensive?
Well, you know, from my perspective, I mean, that kind of question answers itself. It's what we haven't seen that is what we want, the stuff that we haven't seen. You know, any time the story comes in and it's a little bit off the regular, the middle-of-the-road noir, you know, the revenge story, the husband and wife, you know, the wife killing the husband or the you know, the guy who gets offended at the gas station and kills the other guy. All those kind of stories are that you see a lot of are just getting a little bit tiresome. There's a lot of stuff we've published, like strange medical stuff, you know, paramedics, you know, just weird, pushing the envelope of what you would consider noir. That's the stuff that I personally like, or at least sort of perks my ears up. Doesn't mean it always gets in because it's not.
Who was it that wrote that one about the chickens? You remember you guys ran it on Flash Fiction Offensive, and the first line was something like, I still remember the day the chickens exploded, or something like that. And it was this...
Think of Atlantic
like,
City.
I don't...
The chicken hands? No. I don't recall.
No, it was like a story. This guy was on a... Like, he lived on a in a rural area, and a chicken truck... Like,
crashed
in front of the house.
I do remember that, but I remember clicking yes, my vote is in, but I don't remember the story of the name. My memory.
So I thought it was a fucking great story, and it's the kind of thing that I feel like, you know, if you ask somebody, oh, what is noir, what is neo noir, what is crime, they wouldn't have said, oh, it's probably a story about a chicken truck crashing. But when you read it, it definitely has that feeling and it has that mood. But it is like Tom was saying, something new, something different.
Yeah. Push the envelope.
When Tom and I started with Tom and I started this, we very much did it together. You know, I read a story, he read a story, we'd have to agree on it, and we went on just because of time constraints, we adopted this sort of dual editorship where if he sees a story he loves, you know, he has my blessing to accept it. If I have a story I love, you know, he's, you know, by all means take it. But there does happen, there are occurrences where I can put a story up and he can put a story up with the other one not really ever having read it. It doesn't happen often, but we kind of both run our own side of it. I publish on Mondays, he publishes every other Thursday. So, you know, we know each other well enough to know that it's got to be a slam dunk. It's a story like, Tom wouldn't like it, I'm not going to take it. But you can usually tell you can usually tell within, you know, a few paragraphs whether something's working. You can almost, you know, within the first line, it's the line from No, I Won't Read Your Fucking Script. You know, it only takes a page to see if, you know, the writing is good, and it only takes a sentence to see if the writing is bad. And so you can go through pretty fast. But we read everything because we feel like our job, especially at this stage, is to give some kind of constructive feedback so that even if something isn't working, you don't return with a, I mean, I pride myself on never giving a dear writer this piece didn't work for us, you know, sincerely the editor's letter. You know, I read every piece and I take it apart, and even the ones that don't work or, you know, whatever, I want to make sure I go back with something to offer. You know, because people take their time writing this stuff. It's not like anybody tries to send in a story that's not good. There just seems to be a run on certain tropes to get played into the ground. So we see the same story, the hitman story, the wife murdering the husband story, and we get them in droves, and it's really hard to distinguish one from the other when you get so many stories that are covering this, you know, similar subject matter.
Right.
Yeah.
Real quick, I looked it up, and the story is Feast of Feathers by Jeff Weddle, and I'll link that up because I mentioned it. It's
oh yeah,
cool.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Yeah.
That's when I remember writing Steve Whittle that night and saying, "Hey, your story's up tomorrow." And he said, "What are you talking about? I haven't submitted a story to you guys." I realized I had the wrong guy. Oh yeah.
Well, yeah, just, you know, Whittle. Yeah, just Whittle. Yeah.
You know, since last time Tom was on the show, he called me out. I'm going to call Tom out. I remember when Tom asked me when I was going to submit something to Out of the Gutter Online, and it was like 3 days after you guys published my story.
Well, to be fair about me, let me wiggle out of this. It was, first of all, I've been drinking. And you were actually published in Bare Knuckle Pulp. Hey.
But you guys did it. It was you and Joe that did it.
Technically, that's true, yes. But that was the last. That was the last Bare Knuckle Pulp. By the way, that position is still open. We should probably be taking applications to fire up the old Bare Knuckle Pulp department.
I hardly disagree. I want that thing to stay closed. That was a pain in my ass. Flash Fiction Offensive is enough for us to run, and nobody reads long fiction, really. They don't.
No. Joe. What I'm saying is, we need a new editor for that section. I was thinking Court, but you know why? Because we wouldn't have to change a lot of the
name's Court. Because we don't have to change Merrigan, we just have Court, right? We don't change the last name. Hit him up, see if he'll do it. Yeah, I like that.
I will.
That's good. Cool. All right.
I think the trick
was about cutting corners.
You just publish it very.
Are you just using this as a business meeting right now?
Right. Like I feel like they're just now they're like having a meeting, and Jessica and I are like, should we just start having a meeting?
I think people think because we're so intricately linked that we inextricably linked that we see each other a lot. And Tom and I don't see each other a lot. We don't actually talk very often. This is
I actually know
on
that's
Facebook
true.
And so, yeah.
Because trying to get the two of you together in one place is like fucking trying to get Bruce Wayne and Batman together in the same place.
Well, that's actually very easy. Well, that'd be very easy.
You know what I mean?
Resemblance build, tempers flare.
Yeah.
But all right. Well, let's move on from the dastardly Flash Fiction Offensive onto our current project, shall we?
All right, Tom. Last time you were on the show, after you called me out and embarrassed me on my own show, you.
Speaking of resentment, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. I'm just fucking with you. You talked about the book you were working on at the time, and that book's coming out, right? American Hustle or Hustle? Shit, American Hustle's a movie. Hustle was Tom Pitt's book.
Well, actually, the book I was working on at the time was California Libertine, but hey, why split hairs?
No, that's not true. That is not true, Tom. I know it was Hustle. I know it was, and you know what? I can prove it, and it's easy. Go back to your episode and listen to the last 10 minutes where we talk about Hustle.
Well, yeah, I was pushing it because it was
well,
there
you
bag, and I was looking for a home. But and it found a home. I released it with Snubnose, and or they're releasing it for me, rather. And it'll be out at first, I think, actually – technically, it's done, and I'm waiting for the big box of the first copies to show up at my house next week. And I'm excited about it. It's a big old sleazy tale, and I hope the world will not excommunicate me once it's been read.
You want to go over like a general like what the book is about thing, just real quick for anybody who didn't listen to the last episode. I'm sure they're going to go back and listen to it now if they're latecomers. You know, we get new listeners every week, so.
So go back and say, yeah, Renee was right. Pitts, what a liar. In a nutshell, it's about two drug-addicted gay hustlers on the streets of San Francisco who decide to blackmail an elderly client of theirs who turns out to be a defense attorney. Problem is, the defense attorney already has some creepy ex-con tweaker freak that he has a strange relationship living in his house, and that guy is blackmailing him as well about something bigger, darker, more gnarly. So the old guy gets some happy-go-lucky biker to clear out all of his troubles, and that's where the fun really begins. And it's their wild and violent adventure as the thing sorts itself out. And that's sort of the impetus in a nutshell. How's that?
Well, they're not really gay.
That's great.
All right? Well, they're not really gay. They're not really gay hustlers. They are two junkies who perform various, you know,
yeah. Well, they're not gay.
Acts to get their drugs. Well, I mean, I think it's an important point because there's always this element that it's, you know, they're from two different worlds, especially Donnie, who's, you know, caught up in something and trying to get away from it. I mean, there's it doesn't get much lower than, you know, being forced to prostitute yourself for drugs. and especially when it's not even your orientation, I think it's even somehow even more of a slap in the face, and especially for Donnie, who is newer to it, and I think that drives much of the action, this push and pull of who he is and who he wants to be, and you know, the humiliation he's subjecting himself to for you know, to stay addicted, you know, to sports habit.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah,
it's like
I'm glad that Joe knows the book so well, because if he didn't, you know, who would we ask?
Well, I read a very early. I was fortunate enough to read a very early, you know, copy, and Tom did take my suggestions. But outside of that, I was told by how powerful and good it was.
I will use your quote that I know I'm going to shame you on the air now. And when you said, you know, it needs more of that kind of pretty woman thing going on. You know, Joe,
yeah,
no.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I really am. I'm a very mainstream pop guy. I mean, I want to be, you know, I like Hollywood. I like mainstream. I like Taylor Swift. So I'm always trying to soften the edges that are going to alienate readers, because I want, you know, as much of the mainstream popular appeal, while still not sucking, you know, I still want to be good, but I also don't want to alienate. So my criticism and feedback is usually, and yeah, of course you make mistakes. There's one story in the Springsteen anthology, I won't name the author, Todd Robinson, and I screwed up a story. He gave me a great story, and I suggested a change. It was just wrong. I mean, it was geared in the same mold, which is, I like that redemption. I like that. You know, I'm not a traditional noir guy, because I do kind of like the happy ending more than I think most noir writers do. I'm kind of in that replacement spine, one foot in the door, the other in the gutter. I haven't fully committed to that crime lifestyle. So my feedback is always tempered with that idea.
I'm on the other side of the coin. I believe that, although you can't say, you know, fuck it to the rules and what people like doesn't matter, but that great art truly does come from the gut, and there must be something sort of just straight from the heart coming from what you're writing. And thus, and this comes back to Flash Fiction Offensive too, I don't ask people to make at least structural changes to the stories or the plots, and I'm somewhat resistant when I'm asked to make them or think about them for my own stuff. I definitely, oh yeah, well that's missing, and of course that couldn't happen if that person was there, and oh yeah, what did the guy do when he got out of prison? Those kind of questions I will go in and rearrange, but the big storyline things, I just sort of, and it comes from my punk rock upbringing that just says, you know, fuck it, you play what you play, and if it's great, it's great, if it's not, it's not, but you can't change yourself to think you're going to be better in other people's eyes, otherwise you weaken what you present in the long run. I think I said that right. These coors are going to my head.
It's not when the cores are going to your head. But see, the thing that's funny is I feel like, even though, like, Joe says he wants a happy ending, Tom says play what you play.
Not a happy. I don't want everything all neat and tidy and, like, rainbows and butterflies and kittens and stuff. I like the offer of hope.
Hey, if there's no feedback, it's not all
the
real, man.
That's the thing is I don't believe in happy endings in fiction, but I like that there is a glimmer of hope, and it doesn't have to even be like blatant. You just have to feel like, even though everybody is kind of fucked right now, there's a chance that they'll get unfucked at some point.
Yeah.
I don't know. I always go back to my thing. I always, to my example, I always use, which is Cormac McCarthy's No Country for Old Men. Everybody got fucked in that one. I mean, everybody did. I don't recall the hope, and I think that's a great piece of noir, even though it's not considered noir, and I think it's a great book and a great piece of art, and I like stuff that leaves me just sort of wrung out and feeling like, oh, what the fuck, you know, and stuff that leaves me thinking about it when I leave the theater, you know, or close the book, or take the needle off the record, dating myself a little bit there.
Needle off the record. Through the needle.
It's not that Tom's old, it's that he's a hipster. He's all about vinyl these days.
Yeah, wow. Drinking Coors and listening to fucking records, huh? Got your secondhand sweater on? Your ironic facial hair? Got your little tiny hat? All right,
so Joe, you got a book coming out too, right? It's like not that big of a deal or anything. It's just a little book coming out from a small press with no
It's. I'm very excited. Lamentation comes out with Ocean View Publishing in October, and you know, getting an actual print run and hardcover and all that stuff. So yeah, I'm thrilled. I'm kind of. I gave a reading for Junkie Love last night, and I mentioned at the reading it's probably the last time I'm gonna, you know, do that. I mean, I read from the book. I'm sure I'll read from the book, but when Junkie Love came out, I said I'll give it a year to just push this as hard as I can, as fast as I can, and even if it borders on the obnoxious, and I'm sure I went over the line into the obnoxious plenty of times. It was my one chance with a book that was the story of my life. So it'd be nice to move on from that and get into something else, even though I'm still covering the same milieu, the same, you know, low life.
I'm going to tell you why that kind of bothers me, is because when I drove 2.5 hours to listen to you read, you didn't read from Junkie Love. You read something else.
Yeah, sorry about that. What did I read?
A story about a guy getting a pregnancy test or something like that. Or he just got a pregnancy
test. Go. Yeah, I mean,
at the Noir de Bar. I love that story.
It's a great story. I'm just saying that Joe was like, that's never going to happen.
Yeah.
You're just,
well, I'll tell you why, I know that you love the book,
tell you why
it didn't
but it's never going to happen.
Because that was, Junkie Love has a sort of seriousness to it and a sort of weightiness to it. And it's, you know, I mean, it's an introspective book, but the Noir de Bar just seemed like it was not only a lighter occasion, but it was more strictly crime fair. And it just, I think, well, I'm speaking for you, Joe, but it just place, you know, we did go back and forth on what the fuck should we read? And I read something autobiographical too, but I did it for humor's sake.
It was great.
But I think, Renee, didn't you come up for the reading at Shishimi with Rob Pierce and I? Weren't you there for that one as well?
Yeah, but you didn't read from Junkie Love did you?
No, and I didn't read Junkie Love that time either. I think I read Occupation that time.
Yeah, the
but
one with the trumpet.
Twice.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I haven't read Junkie
See, look,
Love either.
Not only do I go to the reading, but I pay enough attention that all this time later, after drinking 12% alcohol beer, that I can remember what the fucking stories were about. How about that?
Wow. Sorry.
And I remember what Tom read at North Bar LA, because I will never forget that story for as long as I live.
Nor will I. Nor will a certain man with tender
little. While we're doing plugs, that is the story that's going to be in the Long Distance Drunks.
Really?
That's the story about the porn booth. Yeah.
I have told Tom for years now, I have begged him to take all these stories of his junkie days and put them in a collection a la Junkie Love and do the same thing, but I have been unsuccessful today. He has all these stories about his time on the street that are fantastic, and they really should be out there in one collection, but that's, you know, what do I know? I'm just...
Like the story about Cancun, for instance.
No, but I remember after Tom read that story, I laughed so hard. I thought that I might cry. I was laughing so hard. And then there was this moment where I'm like, shit, but that really happened.
Yeah.
And then it was like a really awkward thing where I was like, I'm going to go talk to this guy after this. Was I supposed to
But I'm not
going to
gonna shake his hand.
Yeah, but I'm not going to shake his hand.
I'm not gonna touch him.
Well, but it was, speaking of the Long Distance Drunk thing, it's in there, and Max Booth did a great freaking job editing that sucker, because it was, I think, it was the first real time I sat down and wrote a short story. And then when I went back and looked at it, a lot of it had, there's a lot of, you know, passive verse in there, and just a lot of weird phrasing and clunkiness. And he hammered it a little bit more into shape, and I'm proud of it now, and we have to see it come out, I think, next month, right? March it comes out?
March 9th, which, as we covered last week, is either the anniversary of Bukowski's death or his birthday, but Renee doesn't fucking know. I didn't look it up between last week and this week.
I do.
Oh, what is it?
I know Bukowski's birthday is August 16th because he shares a birthday with my daughter, Lula.
Oh, there you go.
Death, then.
So then it's the anniversary of his death. Thank you, Tom.
Wow. Nothing to celebrate there. Jeez. No gloomy.
Well, I mean, you wouldn't have a tribute anthology without him being dead.
I mean, you are in the book that's being released on the anniversary of his death, so I don't know. Joe, what is your story about in there?
Jeez, I don't remember.
It's not like I didn't give you a heads up that we were going to talk about this or anything.
I think it's Sensitive Boys, which is one of the very, very, very first short stories I wrote. that I had lying around that involved a bar in San Francisco.
I was going to say, I sure hope it isn't the same drinking story you sent us for our anthology, or that'd be awkward.
Hey, wait, I got a question. Since a little non sequitur there, what's going on with the Books and Booze anthology?
We're close.
We are very close. We just got it back from our illustrious editor, and we are going through it, making the last final changes, and we're going to be sending this final version of the story out to our gracious donor authors to get them their okay and get a little,
Because I never found out whether I sent something in, but I never got an official acceptance, but I don't know if that's even happening.
Oh, honestly, yeah, it's
happening.
We just accepted anyone who would be nice enough to give us something, because it's all just to benefit the show and keep us on the air for another year. So grateful anyone wanted to give us a story for that.
It's setting the bar high. Good. I'm glad.
Well, if you're on the show, you're already elite. I'm not saying it's only people that were on the show. We don't have terrible authors on the show, right?
I'm in with the in crowd. Yes, of course.
You had Joe Lappin on, didn't you?
No. Unfortunately, we gathered these stories before he was a guest. This is from our first.
I got a whole checklist of things I got to mention. I had to find a way to get Joe Lappin in there so that can come off the list.
And it's also important to mention Mike Moss's name as often as possible, because Mike, there's no other reason why we need to. Other than he just had a book come out, by the way, What Happens in Reno, on that booksy thing down in L.A. that they put out the novellas, and he's got the Gutter book coming out, Sense of New Death. He's cranking them out.
You edited his book, right? Is that...
I did. Well, I'm not much of an editor, so yes. We went back. Oh, it was such a nightmare. At first I stalled, I didn't get it going, and then when I finally did get it going, I had this laptop crash, and I lost all my data, and I felt so dejected. I was like, man, I can't even think about it. I had to start over again from the start. And then, it took way longer than we thought, but it is finally coming together. I've seen the cover. It looks classy. It looks beautiful. Story's good. It's weird, a la Mike. If the term dirty noir was not already coined, it should be coined for him, because that seems to be his forte.
All right. That's
all right.
There you go.
We'll make sure and...
I know that
on the show?
Not out yet.
He is. No, here's the thing that's interesting, is that Mike is probably the most oft-mentioned person on the show. He's never been on the show. He got a package from us full of Books and Booze swag because he was a major donor to the show, but he has not been on the show. Now he has a book, though.
Something to push. Yeah, he's got two.
Yeah.
He's got two novellas in the air. So, get him on. Then we can
here's
your Facebook page with questions about him.
A while back, I read one of them. I don't know which one it is. I don't know if it's the one that's out or it's a different one, but I read one of his novellas.
Yeah.
Oh, funny.
Yeah.
It's really prolific.
Joe, you want to mention yours or my current projects, or is that too far in the bag? Is that behind the curtain still?
Why don't I mention your current project and you mention mine?
It's easy because although our agent said you guys got to stop reading each other's stuff because it's too similar.
I know.
I don't feel it's similar.
It's funny. But she said she read Skunk Train, which is the one I'm working on. And the first thing she said, I was like, "What's your biggest criticism?" She said, "You and Tom need to stop reading each other's work." But the funny thing is neither he nor I read the other person's work while we were finishing these two books. But they do have some eerie similarities. But that's mostly because we're best friends.
But stylistically, they are, in my opinion, miles apart. They're different things. But there are just weird.
There are just weird little.
Weird little
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, cigarettes.
Fire away there, Clifford.
No, I was just kidding. I don't really. That's just so adorable. You tell your story, and then I'll tell mine.
Well, I was hoping that I could squeeze out of you the comparison thing, so I could use it for not the one you already mentioned, but so I could use it, because I was supposed to email that later tonight. But my book's called California Libertine. It is done. It is in the bag. I'm very proud of it. I think I stepped it up from the last book, and I hope it does great things. and that is the hope of the agent anyway. And I don't need to give away too much about it because it's going to be a year and a half before it finds a home, and I start yakking about it all the time. But it rocks. It's Northern California, violent, crazy, and classy as hell.
It sounds like it sounds like at least a 4-star book.
Watch it.
Yes.
The thing is that I asked Jessica, we message each other throughout the show sometimes. I asked her if I should make the joke or not, and then I didn't wait for her answer because it just felt right.
Yeah.
That's great. That was worth the price of
me. There it went.
Well, making the joke with me, you're not in danger of hurting my feelings, but you are in danger of receiving a barb back. You know what I mean? So watch out.
Right. No, I know. Because, see, and the thing with Tom is he lets it stew for a while, right? Because he called me out on it, and I thought it was over. But then, last month, he was 2 blocks away from my house, didn't even let me know he was in town.
Yeah.
Well, I was having a family vacation down there. I told Cheryl, I said, I think Renee lives here, but I was me. And, we had an urgency to get out there and eat our peyote and be with the cactuses. You know, we had to do.
Time will take the skunk train
on down there. Nice segue, huh, Joe?
There you go.
Thank you, Tom.
Because we only have,
Tom's
like,
stories.
This is so awkward.
Stories about a teenage kid from Willits going down to San Francisco, and my story is completely different. It's about a teenage kid that's on the run from Willits down to San Francisco, but then he also goes to L.A. See how the difference is? A little twist on it, a little further. It's two teenage kids with stolen pot on the run from the mob is the gist of it. But it's, I want to do a love story because I want to do a love story. You know, I thought, like, if you could kind of, you know, tap into that. I don't really do love stories, and I don't ever really write from a female's point of view. So to get a strong female character and from a female point of view is something I want to do, and I think I did that. I mean, it's my favorite thing I've written. Whether, you know, it works will be judged by others, but I love it. So I'm just back to
my favorite thing you've written too, Joe.
Thanks, Tom. I don't think it's our agent's favorite thing, but what are you going to do?
No, the
thing we're supposed to do is get better, right? So that's natural. So I mean that sincerely. I think is the best of you know, it's a progression, and that's
yeah. I hope so. I mean, I want to
So now this is the book you said, and I want to bring this up because I think that our listeners, or at least some of our listeners, they like me, so they must think like me a little bit, are going to love this. But this is the novel that you said you based one of the characters on your wife, right?
Yes. I wanted to use metonymy where California becomes, you know, its own, you know, character itself, the personification. So I have the story beginning high in California, ending low in California to mirror the narrative arc of a, you know, character's downward trajectory. But I based the female character, Lizzie, on my wife. She loves the book because it's based on her. She's always been telling me I should write a book about her. She thinks she's fascinating. So she was really happy with it.
She is. No, she is. She's a lovely person. I met her.
She's fucking fascinating.
She's
yeah,
wonderful. Yeah.
I don't know why she...
You did.
No. Yeah.
I'm sure you deserve, I'm sure you deserve
Robbie
each
Rose
other.
Fine. No, you know the Robbie Rhodes steamer song, I Put a Baby in You, because you kept talking about going back to college? That's kind of what I, you know, once she's got the baby, I'm forever. Look it up, Robbie Rhodes steamer. I Put a Baby in You. It's one of the greatest fucking things you'll ever see.
I'm gonna link it.
Robbie
Rhodes
steamer. It's awesome. Shit, I got to hear that now. All right. Yeah, go on. Any other questions?
Yeah, I want you guys to publicly address Eric Buettner's question. You guys, well, okay, he's got several. Who the hell do you guys think you are? But also, for two writers so linked by friendship, proximity, and common background experience, have you ever thought of collaborating a novel? And I know Joe answered this in the group, but I want to hear from both of you on the air.
It's a little awkward and hurtful because I was like, yeah, I totally write with Tom. I'd love to do that. And Tom's like, no, I wouldn't do that. It's kind of like sharing your feelings. I'm like, no, I just, yeah, I love her. She's great. No, I just, you know, I think of him as a friend, but that's cool.
Well, here, listen. Yeah, I'll tell you why. At this point, I don't. You know, if we can divot any success out of these careers. Maybe further down the line it would make more sense, but right now it doesn't make a lot of sense. Plus, our tastes and our styles are not as similar as one may think from having similar backgrounds. And I wouldn't want to, you know, when it comes to prose and the rhythm of language, we do tend to bump heads. But what we did discuss and what we should attempt sometime.
Joe, I think you just got friend zoned.
No.
Yeah, I mean, that was brutal, huh? That was tough to listen to. Did you hear that?
Don't want to ruin our friendship.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Bob.
What we have discussed, and I think we should do it before too much time goes by, is try to write a screenplay together. And I do think that, because, you know, we can get on board with storyline, we can throw stuff back and forth, and we can create characters. But I think if I was trying to foist my bros on Joe and vice versa, that, you know, it would be a big project. We got so much on our plates right now, it'd be tough to work something in. But I'm just scared of collaborating because I don't have a lot of knowledge of the inner workings of the language and stuff like that. I just write what I write and it comes out. And after that,
See what he did there?
Shit
on me for 10 minutes. And then at the very end, he's like, but hey, it's because I don't know how to write as well as Joe. See what he did? He did that whole...
You need to learn how to rewrite, and, you know, that's... okay.
Well, you got to rewrite. You got to. That's not my thing. Writing is rewriting. That's what you got to do.
Yeah,
I'm just trying to help, man.
But I don't
know
that adage that writing is 10% writing and 90% rewriting. I don't buy that whole thing. I think just like...
I'm going to agree with you, Tom. I'm going to agree with you because I think that some people, the percentages differ.
I will say this, and I know this from experience, that with music, if you don't get it in the basic tracks, when the guy in the studio is telling me, don't worry about it, we'll fix it in the mix, then it's bullshit and it's not going to work. If you don't have the basic tracks down there in the first place, then there's nothing to build on. You can tweak the knobs all you want, but if the initial product isn't there, it's not going to work. So that's
yeah. You got to have the basic track. There's no disagreement about the basic tracks analogy. You need
all
the
right.
basic tracks.
Okay.
That's what you got to have. But it really is a difference in style that Tom and I have. And neither, you know, all kidding aside, neither right or wrong. It's a matter of, you know, the stream of consciousness or getting it out faster. That school of your first thought, your best thought, and going that way. You know, if you're going to take a guess on a test, your instinct's usually right. I work completely the other way because I'm not very good at drafting. Drafting is a painful, cumbersome process for me. It takes someone told me the other night, it's like, oh my God, the guy walks in the room and then he says hi and then he grabs a beer and it's just brutal. I'm reading it. I'm like, holy fuck, I suck. So to me, to get to the stage where writing is fun, I really have to do the layers, you know, so it's a very, it's a timed process. It goes in stages. It's not something that happens fast. It's and maybe it's from years I painted and, you know, you're building, you know, layer upon layer, and I don't know why, but for whatever reason, that's how I chose to write, and so you get all that shit down, and then it's taking away the parts that suck, and it's very much a composition for me is how I look at writing.
I actually just said to somebody, that you've got to, like I said, you've got to let go of the idea that everything you write has to be good. Being finished is better than being good. If you've got a really great first half of a story and there's no second half, it doesn't fucking matter if it was good. And one of the things that changed, that took me from being someone who wrote as a hobby to being someone who took writing seriously and had stuff that I was comfortable putting out there in the world, was I literally took that Ernest Hemingway quote, all first drafts are shit, and I put it, this was before smartphones, so it was like on, when you turn your phone on, like there'd be a, like your phone number would pop up. I replaced that with that quote, and I had it as the background on my computer screen, and I had it everywhere, so I would see it all the time for like a year. I just like brainwashed myself on that.
That's the Anne Lamott, Shitty First Drafts, from probably the best writing book I ever read, Bird by Bird. It's giving yourself permission to write that. David Corbett has I've seen him up at Book Passage when he talks about this teaching writing workshop. He's a friend, but this is what he said during the workshop, was that, you know, the first stage is I'm a genius, which is you just write down, and everything you say is brilliant, and you don't question it. Every line you write has got to be brilliant. And then you go into the I'm an idiot stage when you're editing, which is, you know, cutting and slashing and being as hard on yourself as possible. And I kind of use that philosophy because I'm a, you know, perfectionist just by, you know, whatever nature. And it's really hard to read something that isn't good. You know, it's hard to read something that you'd be embarrassed to show somebody. And unfortunately, until I get to those later stages, you know, I remember my wife was reading over my shoulder. It ended up becoming probably my favorite story I've ever written, which is the story in All Due Respect, what's it called? Fuck the Captain. And but the line was, it was something about a guy in a pimp suit and like fucking feathers and like the way you see a stereotypical pimp. And I remember her reading on my show, like, what is that? And those are things you just write to get down, to get the picture in your head, and you go back and you make it not suck. But having a read on my shoulder, those words was brutal because you never want anybody to see you in those, you know, initial stages, because some of the stuff you come up with is just awful.
My husband supports me, so I never let him see the initial stages. I don't want him to look and go, holy fucking shit, go get a day job. But no, I think it's interesting, though, is like, you know, there is that point where what you said is you have to write it because you need it, and then later you take it out. And I remember the first time that somebody said that in a way that hit me, as opposed to, like, you know, there's, like, oh, you, like Stephen King always says, you edit a third out. And you're like, but what third?
Actually, my writing relationship with Tom is kind of lopsided because I have the much easier job. When Tom gives me a first draft, it's pretty much done. It's like 90% just there. When I give him a first draft, it's really, really awful, and I feel bad. The first draft he read of Skunk Train was just terrible. It was terrible. And I mean, he liked it because he could see the story, and he has the ability to see the story, but the writing itself was bad, and I ended up changing, you know, at least half the text.
Wait a second. That comes from your style of how you do it. You felt like, okay, I want to get this whole story down. I'm just moving forward, blasting forward, going further each day, rolling through it, and then you go back to the start and are able to go and wrench it through and make it what it is. Me, I heard Les Edgerton say the same thing, which I do it with short stories, I do it with novels. You know, if I get sort of stuck or I'm not sure what's going on, I go back to the start and I edit as I write so much that by the time I do finish, whether it's a story or a novel, it's you know, it does feel like it's close to the end of the first draft. Then I pass to someone else and they, you know, find some holes. But it's just my method of having to constantly go to the start. So the first section I've gone over like a million times by the time the first draft is done. So that's just a difference in approach. So
right.
There you go.
I mean, I tend to put a lot more adverbs than stay in the end. I use the word just and very an awful lot, lots of sort of, lots of, you know, bits and littles and sums, and these are things you have to go through, and it's just these extra words because that's how I write, because that's how I talk. And leaving, I mean, Liz, our agent, got a version of Skunk Train before I'd gotten rid of all the adverbs, and there was something like 600 still in there, which is pretty brutal for somebody to read 600 adverbs in a novel. But that's just how I write. I put it all in there, and then I, you know, what's the sculpting line? Was it one of those Michelangelo or something? You know, the sculpture's already there in the rock, and you just kind of take away the other parts, and that's how I look at writing, not comparing myself to Michelangelo, although I just did, so there's no real way to
do it. I was going to say, I took a course. I've taken two with her now, but I took this. The first course I took with Lydia Yuknovich, if you haven't read her memoir, Chronology of Water, I don't know what you're doing with your life that you think is more important, but you're wrong. But she said to me, I have a child, too. I read the book. Come on.
I know.
She said to me, she highlighted a portion of the text, and she said, I know that you had to write this in order to say what you say next, but you don't need it anymore. And just having somebody actually like point out like this specific part, and I see what you did, and I understand it, and you don't, all of a sudden, I feel like that changed my writing for the every day after that.
Where well, yeah, it's knowing which ones work, but knowing which parts need to stay.
Right.
Like cool story.
Now I can see it clearly.
You can
now
cut
I'm like
the first chapter out of a first draft. You know, you can usually drop.
I think the first 10 pages of Skunk Train is now one paragraph. Literally, 10 pages became one paragraph. I didn't need any of that. It was just all set up in my own head. So, you know, then you whittle it down to just the essential, because people don't really like to read is the thing. Like, they'll read until you give them an excuse to stop reading. People are busy. There's lots of books. Everyone has a book, you know. And once you start dawdling and having people walking through town where they're not really doing anything, and you're setting up all this character stuff that's mildly interesting to you, but it's not interesting at all to somebody else who has, you know, 15 books in their TBR.
I have characters that I would happily write their whole lives out, but I know that nobody would fucking read that shit.
That's right. Just because it's fun to play doesn't mean it's fun to listen to. That's what Dan Jude used to say when we were in a band together.
We're running out of time, and we're going to play Second Coming by The Wandering Jews, because The Wandering Jews is Joe's band, and it's the second time that Joe and Tom have been on the show, and it's also, well, actually, it's the third time we played a Wandering Jews song, because the first song we played was You Weren't Even My Favorite Ex-Wife, because that is the best song title ever. And then we played one off of All the Pretty Things, which was I Dance for You. It happens to be my favorite Wandering Jews song. And then here we go. Second Coming. Who's on next week, Jessica?
Hold on.
Mike Monson.
Hold on.
Mike Monson. We should probably tell you right now, Mike Monson is just a creation of Tom and I. Have you ever seen Mike Monson? We made him up.
Tony
Never
McMillan
met
is going to be up
Tony
next
McMillan.
Week.
Oh, Nefarious Twit. Which has been, people have been really talking about that book a lot, and I'm about to dive into it, and I'm excited. So that's going to be a good episode. Like I said, we're playing Second Coming by The Wandering Jews as a song. I will acknowledge that Tom also was in a band once, and we should have asked him for a song, but we didn't because we're assholes. Anyway, guys, thanks so much for coming on the show. This was a ton of fun.
Thank you for having us.
When they let me out, I'm coming.